Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 144 with the title, Breaking Barriers, Building Futures. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Sandeep Amar Gupta. Sandeep is a transformational coach and speaker who empowers leaders and professionals to overcome growth barriers and create meaningful futures through an integrated approach blending spiritual insight, human potential, and economic strategies. When I asked Sandeep to describe his superpower, he said, it is his ability to bridge ancient wisdom and modern thought in order to unlock human potential. Hello, Sandeep. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I love being here.
Thank you. We were chatting in the green room before we went live that I'm based in the UK and you're based in which part of India?
I am based in the northern part of India, the capital of India, that's New Delhi. And at present, it is cold and getting colder, but nothing like what you experience in UK.
Yes, it's about 10 degrees where I am in the south of the UK. What's New Delhi like this time of year in December?
In New Delhi this time would be something like 14, 15, goes down to approximately 8, 9 in the early morning hours. But this is the pattern, you know, which continues. While where you are, the temperature will continue to fall. It won't fall so much as far as Delhi is concerned. Well, we do have the Himalayas where it's snowing. It goes to minus 30, 40. But Delhi, where I am, is quite comfortable, you know, in the winters.
India itself is almost a continent in its own right. It's a massive country. We often don't appreciate it when we're in the Northern Hemisphere. Just think about it, it's down there somewhere. But really, it's a massive place in its own right with a massive population. Was it 20-something states within India?
Well, 32 states.
32.
And you're right. India is a very ancient country. One of the oldest traditions it has. And it has everything, right from the mountains to the seas, to the deserts, to the forests, to the rainforests. Diversity of culture, all colors are here. And surprisingly, let me tell you one thing. You know, India became a hotbed for clinical trials, you know, a couple of years back. Why? The genetic composition of India has got genes from virtually all the races across the globe in India. So if you, you know, evaluate a drug in the Indian subcontinent and in India in particular, you can be rest assured it is going to work. At least in 60-70% of the world population. So India is a fantastic country. A lot of history, a lot of color, a lot of romance, a lot of movies, you name it, and we have it.
Well, I'm not necessarily a fan of the Bollywood, but I'm well aware of the Bollywood culture, the dance, the color, the vibrancy. I'm a great fan of Indian dancing. That's the way people move their fingers and their arms and they get with the rhythm. And I'm transfixed sometimes watching Indian dancing because it's so culturally different to Western dancing and it's a very deliberate dance, isn't it? I think very rhythmic and transfixing sometimes.
Well, I'd say dance anywhere in the world is transfixing if done.
Mm.
Inherently, we are made to move inherently. Excuse me. As for the ancient Indian wisdom, what is flowing inside us? It is the sound waves. And why do we dance? When we align, or the sounds in the external world, they align with our internal sounds, dancing is automatic. I believe world over, be it in the Africa or UK or anywhere, dancing is transfixing, if done properly.
Yeah, I agree. Even as long as you, in your head, when you're dancing, you have this vision. I think it doesn't matter what you look like when you dance, it's how you feel on the inside when you dance. If you let yourself feel that freedom, let go of the shackles of expectations, dancing is a way of losing yourself into the rhythm of the music or the mood, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Joe. And let me share a recent experience, you know. When I was young, I was fond of dancing, and I would dance at every opportunity, you know, but as our societies are, when you grow up, you say, oh, you should not dance, you should not do this, you should not do that. That was very much prevalent in a certain segment in India. So every time I would go to a party, every time I would hear good music, internally I felt like dancing. But something used to hold me. So despite wanting to dance, I was not dancing. And I think this happens to a lot of people. On the 29th of the last month, I was invited to a party. There was a dance floor. And the host said, you got to dance. And I was wanting to dance, but something was holding me back, inhibitions. And then I said, I got to do it. And I went and danced, and people said, you danced well. So, you know, I am going to write a post on this thing. I just got the photographs today. What does it take to break inhibitions? One thought and one step. That is all.
Yeah, thinking and then take action. Effectively, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when you said thinking and taking action, let me share another very important example, which I give. I'm using the word important. The relationship between knowledge and action. It's the relationship of a bullet and a gun. If you're in danger, I give you a bullet, it has got no value. If I give you a gun, don't give you a bullet, again, it has got no value. But the moment I give you the gun and the bullet, it becomes powerful. It changes
the skill
everything.
To fire it, and the skill and knowledge to fire it as well.
That goes, yes, that is true, and the skill. Yes. But what I'm trying to say, and why was I drawn to your podcast or this talk? Inclusiveness, and this is one example of inclusiveness where you bring knowledge and action together, you make them inclusive. You become a powerhouse.
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right. Without action, they're just thoughts, they're just dreams, they're just want to be's. Action turns them from those inaction into something tangible, something that can change, create, develop. And I think we see that too much. Everyone wants, without the action, it just becomes a dream.
That is true. That is true. And in my work, in my practice, as a breaking growth barrier or a transformative coach, this is the main thing I find, that people are capable, they have all the potential, but something is holding them back. And when you help them to remove what is holding them back, they unleash their potential. But the question is, identification of what is holding them. And I find that most of the people, or majority of the people, and even the coaches to a large extent, falter over here. They don't realize we live in two worlds simultaneously. The external world, which is the world in which we are born, we breathe, take actions, results manifest for us. And our inner world of love, our inner world of aspirations, our inner world of beauty, values, experiences, consciousness, etc., etc. Our inner world drives that external world.
A lot of what you're saying there relates to spirituality, doesn't it? It's the inner sense of self, our inner peace, our inner happiness. And something I think is lost in the Western world often is spirituality. We get confused between religion and spirituality and being in connection with ourselves, with our surroundings, with the people around us. How do you start to understand that aspect of your culture, and how do you use that cultural element to sort of develop your thinking in terms of business?
First of all, I would like to make a small correction. The West has not lost spirituality. West is equally spiritual like the East. Only thing is, spirituality is a spectrum. You might be standing on a starting station. I might be standing on a station which is much more advanced. But you are also journeying, so am I. That is the East and the West. Spirituality is an inherent part of the human existence. Now, why do I say so, Joe? There are three words. Spirit, spiritual, and spirituality. You agree with me? We all have souls?
Yeah, I'm not religious, but I believe I have a soul. Yes.
You have a soul. I'm not talking of religion. I'm just not talking of religion. And spirituality and religion, they're two different things. You have a soul. That is the spirit. That is the spirit. In whatever, it gets poured. It's got poured in the human body. So the human body becomes spiritual. And when we humans, with the soul in our body, we start walking from gross selfishness, me, 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 I, to gross selflessness, we are us. This journey is called spirituality. Why? Because what are the characteristics of the spirit? Love, mutuality, refulgence, intelligence, wisdom, good for all. And what are the characteristics of the body? Selfishness, organic satisfaction, organic survival, and organic multiplication. The body does not know a fourth thing. This is the way nature has made us. And in between the body and the soul is our mind, the thought process, which keeps on oscillating between the body and the mind, and reacts depending at what was its position when the external stimulus comes in. If the mind was focusing more towards the body when there's a stimulus, your reaction would be selfish. And if the mind was more towards the soul, your reaction would be selfless. So if you map your thoughts and actions for 24 hours, you will find inconsistency in them.
I think you can tell when an organization or an individual has a soul. People operate. And it's, I think for me, a soul goes beyond a conscience, a restraint. It's soul is a bit, it's about your inner self, your inner truth, your inner being, your values, your brand, what you stand for, just your whole essence and purpose in life comes out of your soul. And I often see this where I'm dealing with people or organizations where they don't connect that humanity to their actions. And I see great examples when people do that. And I feel rewarded by interacting with those people.
Joe, an organization, like the human body, is divided in three parts. The soul, the mind, and the body. Similarly, an organization is divided in three parts. The people, they are the soul of the organization. On top of the people is the culture of the organization. And on top of the culture is the business, the transactional business which we do. Buying, selling, reporting, controlling, relationships. Now, the people, their values, their thoughts, they drive the culture of the organization. And the culture of the organization decides and drives whether the business strategies are ethical or not. So the challenge arises, you know, in modern-day management is, they don't integrate the three. You've got to integrate the three. You've got to look at the larger picture, the whole picture. You've got to apply systems thinking, see what is impacting what, and then take actions. In business also, you know, the chaos theory equally applies. But then, today, unfortunately, our managers and leaders are so short-sighted. They're so impatient. They want profits. They don't want to create value for society. And if you're ethical, which means you've got the right culture, and the right culture means if you have the right motivation and the right people, in your team, then you start building value for the society. And now, you'll agree with me, Joe, there are no free lunches. If you give something to someone, they would respond. So when you add value to society, you enter a very different league of business. Look at Apple. They added value to society. Look at Disney. Walt Disney, he added value to society. Look at Google. They added value to society.
How can leaders in organizations reconnect with this inner consciousness and awareness? Because I think sometimes what happens is we get caught up in our day-to-day activities. You know, you mentioned becoming short-sighted, becoming impatient, becoming target-driven, becoming financial outcome-driven, and lose sight of the people. How do we step back? And when we realize one day that we have lost sight, how do we stop and go back, figure it out again?
Before I answer that question, let me share a very important empirical research results. You see, because of physics, chemistry, the science, which we have been following for the last 100 years, we have become very data-oriented in our thought process. Anything subjective has taken a backseat. Now, to get that subjectiveness back, I would like to present this data. It's a research done by Sisodia. Raj Sisodia was a professor in Wharton School. And the research is called Friends of Endearment. Now, what he did was he selected around 60-odd groups across the world, which comprised of the S&P 500, the companies which were there on the S&P 500, and companies which also fell in the Great to Greater Index. And he shortlisted them on the basis of the human values they were following. If they were following human values in their business strategies, he shortlisted them. So he made a group of 60-odd companies who were following human values and business strategies. And then he did an analysis of the valuation which they had achieved vis-a-vis S&P 500 average and the good to great average. Joe, you'll be surprised. These companies who were following human values, they had grown by 15x over a period of 10 years in comparison. Why? I offer a simple explanation for that. We got to look at business differently. What is business? Business is a socio-economic relationship between three sets of people. Relationship between three sets of people. And who are the three sets? The people who establish the business, the owners, people who support the business, workers, banks, stakeholders. The third set, people who consume the services and the products of the business. So these are the three sets of people who come together and make a business successful. And why does a business become successful when these three sets are together? Because they're helping each other to help themselves. This is very important. They're helping each other to help themselves. And since business is a socio-economic relationship between three sets of human beings, so anything and everything which applies to a human being would also apply there. I ask everyone a simple question. You go to Harrods, it's the world-renowned store, right? You buy something from there, you say, I've got it from Harrods. If the sales girl or the sales man misbehaves with you, shows you out, says, this is not a store for you, will you go back to Harrods? You will not. It's happened in India. Like the Indian kings, you know, they were very rich. When they used to go to England or Europe, like this is the case of, I think, the Gwalior, King of Gwalior, he went to Europe, went to the Rolls-Royce showroom. He was shooed away. Hey man, brown skin, go away, go away. You can't afford it. He was insulted. And then he said, buy all the cars in the showroom and tells us, ADC, make the payment in cash. The salesman was taken aback. The manager was taken aback. They used to sell one car a month. Now here's a man standing saying, okay, buy 50 cars. And in front of them, he says, now use them to pick up the waste in my kingdom. So obviously, the Rolls-Royce guys got disturbed. They said, what? Our cars, which are supposed to be the premium cars, luxury cars, only the who's who use them. And they are going to be used as municipal vans to pick up the trash of the city. They came and said, sorry, and all that stuff, you know, and he said, okay, I'll not do it. But this was an example of relationship going bad, of making a relation, not focusing on the relationship. So personally, I believe whatever applies to human beings equally applies to businesses.
Anecdote story, it's basically saying that you have to value people and the relationship, because that is your brand, what your organization stands for, and how it will be judged. And if you treat people badly, you treat your customers without respect, then that sets the value of your brand. So when we talk about these various initiatives in business, diversity, inclusion, all these buzzwords we talk about, it's about how we treat people, how we make people feel about ourselves as an individual and ourselves as a brand, as an organization. And it's what we stand for, which is part of what you're saying there. Because if a Rolls Royce is treated as a rubbish collection, it shows that's the value you associate with that brand. And that came from the way you were treated by the person you dealt, not by the organization, but by the person you dealt, because they set face off the brand, don't they?
You're absolutely right. And the other thing, you know, which leaders got to recognize, are they playing a game for immediate results or are they playing a game for long-term results? If they're playing the game for immediate results, they could win. They could be awarded everything. But what happens tomorrow? You know, surprisingly, I was reading somewhere, Google, when they have the meetings, they don't talk on the numbers, they don't talk of money, they talk of what value would they be adding in the coming year to the product and people.
Yeah, I think what we often do is we focus on the wrong output. What are we trying to add? Is it just shareholder value? Or, as you say, about creating something that's valuable to the world, the human species?
It's actually both, you know. Within the organization, you've got to create value for each other. Values, you see, like a house, a stack of bricks does not build a house. You need cement or glue to put the bricks together, and then it becomes a house. So in the team environment, you need ethics and values to bind people together into a team. You see, a person who is straightforward, believes in honesty, believes in truthfulness, believes in transparency. Do you think the person can work with someone who believes in nothing of these? Not really. Even if he or she takes the job, that will only be temporary because the needs might be surpassing. Their needs might be surpassing and must be so pressing that they accept the job, but they leave the company at the first option. And leaders got to realize one thing, that losing £1 million or $1 is not so bad. It's into losing a good worker.
Yes. It's like the military thing, isn't it? A plane is replaceable, but the pilot is not.
Right, exactly. This is a brilliant example. I remember hearing one of the top industrialists of India in a management conference. He said, when I make a loss of 10 million, I don't sleep for 10 nights. But when my senior manager leaves me, I don't sleep for 10 months. People said, why? He said, you're forgetting one thing. He was the guy who was producing the results for me. He has left me and joined someone else. With him, he has taken all the trade secrets of mine. He knows exactly my weaknesses and strengths. To retain my position, I will need to work double and triple, because now I also need to counter what he could do, which makes the situation more complex and difficult. So the system, you know, of the pink slip, I don't like your face, here's the pink slip, is having its own repercussions.
I'm a great believer that inherently human beings are positive, want to contribute, want to do a great job, want to do great work. And it's often down to how they're treated, how they're interacted with, that sets the tone. of their own sort of commitment and how they interact with organizations. I often feel that whilst the person has a knowledge that is valuable, I always see it as a personal failure if I'm not able to work with that person for a positive result. And it's not, as I say, it's not selfishly about what their skills and knowledge. It's about the human side. I want that person to succeed. And if they're not succeeding, what can I do to change that? It's kind of the attitude I...
Now, let me take it as if a leader was asking me this question, right? What can I do to change that thing? The question is, how are you connecting with the person? Now, let me get some neurobiology. The prefrontal cortex, which is the executive brain, the amygdala, which is the emotional brain. Now, what happens? I am entering the cabin, and I know my boss shouts at me. It causes pain. Now, since we are hardwired to avoid pain in any and every circumstance, the prefrontal cortex shuts off. Amygdala takes over. That's the emotional brain. And the emotional brain knows only three things: fight, flight, or freeze. So now my boss is going on for half an hour. You did this, you did that, you should have done this, you should have done that. You are a fool, blah, 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 blah. Nothing is registering because my prefrontal cortex is shut. Now, if the leader realizes this thing, recognizes this thing, and says, okay, come in, let's have a talk, as you rightly said earlier, and says, okay, Sandeep, the target was this. You could not achieve it, but whatever you have achieved, that's great. Tell me the reason. How can I help you? What should we do so that the next time you will achieve the target? Because his ranting was also to achieve the target. The goalpost is not shifting. Only the style of interacting with me is shifting. Now, let me share a life example with you. There was a company. They hired me to help them to bring the right energies into the right place. They were at 800 million. That was their turnover. They wanted to increase the turnover to 1,600 million in 1 year. And there was a market. There was a market. But this 100% growth had rattled the entire team. Because this team was coming from a government setup where 5 to 10% growth was a growth to celebrate and party. So when we went there, what they told us, me and my team, that look, the energy is very low. You do something, give them a motivation talk, do this, do that, etc., etc., and make sure that they are full of energy. So we went there, we used certain techniques, and then we realized the problem is not the energy is low, the problem is something else. People are not feeling wanted. People are not feeling a part of the organization. People are not feeling being heard. They are not feeling important. So we got them into a room, used a lot of techniques where we got them to define their vision, their mission, their values as a collaborative team, where each and every member of the 32 people team participated. So now this thing did three things, Joe. Number one, it created a bond between the 32 people. And since the bond was created and sub-teams were created and they were helping each other, so the probability of something slipping between two chairs and no one bending to pick it up got eradicated. Since the values, vision and mission were created by the entire 32, they became committed to it. And I did a very simple thing. I said, okay, you guys tell me, what are the strengths of your organization? So 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 strengths came. I said, okay, brilliant. Every day you come to office, yes, sir. Give me 3 strengths which you bring to office. So now 33 people into 3 was 99 strengths were about. Well, some would be duplicate, etc. Earlier, they said 10. And now they were unique for 35 or 40 strengths. So look, guys, if you join hands, it's not 10. It's 35 strengths you have. And with 35 strengths, can you achieve the 100% growth? Yes, we can. And they achieved 90% of the target. That's a huge, huge thing to celebrate. This assignment was done around 2 years back. I was talking to the CEO the other day. The energy is still high. So when you bind people together, you show them a path. You don't micromanage. You treat them well. You give them a good culture, a good atmosphere. People perform. And the manager's got to understand when someone commits a mistake, he or she knows that they have committed a mistake. So don't rub it in.
You mentioned in some of the notes you put together before the show about, you called it total worldliness as opposed to unworldliness. How do you frame that about?
There are three words. Worldliness, gross worldliness. You only think of the material, nothing else than the material. And you can go to any extent to achieve that material. So values, love, mutuality, nothing comes into play. If need be, you could kill, you could rob, you could do anything to achieve the material. That's the gross worldliness. On the other hand, is gross unworldliness. Now, what is that unworldliness? Hey, I don't want it, you. First you. No, I'll sacrifice. No. You got to protect your self-interest. So that is gross unworldliness. And the third thing is a better worldliness, where you balance both the things. You come to the center point, the midpoint, where you apply the principle of self-preservation, self-protection, self-defense. Now, when I say this thing, it does not allow me to harm anyone to protect myself and create a world on the basis of love, mutuality, where there's an opportunity for everyone to educate themselves, to live healthy, to work, to unleash their potential and live peacefully and happy. I know this might sound like a utopian idea, but then we've got to have a goal to move towards, to do something. So this is the reason I say better worldliness is my goal.
The problem we face as a human species often is these, you mentioned the amygdala, the fight, flight, freeze, the vagus nerve. Our human psyche is geared up against self-protection. And when we feel threatened or when we experience things that are outside of our control, we retreat back into this defensive mode. So in our business world, in society, catch ourselves before we become, before the amygdala kicks in, basically, before we become emotionally driven.
Well, achieving a 100% state is impossible. But yes, controlling yourself is possible. And the entire Indian ancient wisdom focuses around this thing. You know, it's a four-step formula, you know, which I propose. Number one, attention management. Learn to manage your attention. Learn to manage your attention, because without your attention, without focusing on anything, you cannot do anything. Attention is fundamental. Once you learn to manage your attention, learn to observe properly. Now, Joe, you would say, we are observing properly. I know there's a book over there and there's a cat over there. When I say observe properly, observe externally and internally. Because whenever there's a thought, there's a stimulus, there's something, first it manifests and reacts internally. It's an internal bodily reaction which manifests externally. For example, if you don't like someone and that person is approaching, is coming towards you, you'll have a strange feeling, some part of your body would twitch, or would get, what should I say, might just get agitated, your heartbeat might start running fast, whatever it could be. And then you greet that person with a grumpy face. Now, so this is the observation part, right? Or you know you're going to blow up. You're going to shout because your heart has started beating. Now, between the beating of your heart and shouting, there is a small gap. So the third stage is pause. Put your finger on the gap. If you observe, between the internal reaction and the external manifestation, there's a small gap. That is pause. Practice pause. Now, the pause could be for a fraction of a second, 1/100th of a second. Catch that point. And when you catch that point, amygdala opens the doors, lets go of you, and the prefrontal cortex receives the stimulus.
Yes,
and now you say, okay, now you say that, look, I was angry with this guy for what he did in 1960. But today is 2024. The man could have changed. The woman could have changed. She might be coming with a proposal for me. That is the prefrontal cortex thinking. The fight is not over here. The fourth point is acceptance, which is the mother of everything. Accept reality as it is, without any riders, without any justifications, without any excuses. For example, I have failed in an exam. And Joe says, Sandeep, tell me, how was the result? I cannot lie to Joe. Right? I said, Joe, I failed. You know, it was bad luck. What had happened? I'll cook up a story and tell Joe. This is the way we accept reality. 99.9% cases. I say, Joe says, what's the result? Joe, I have failed. Be real. Now, the act of failing is causing me pain. I'm not hardwired for pain. So automatically, I start thinking of, why did I fail? What can I do so I don't fail again? Whereas in the first case, bad luck. I met with an accident. I slept. I was having fever. I am shifting my attention from the act of failure to something else. And I never find the solution. So therefore, I call this thing AOPA formula. And I've learned it from life. So if a person follows this thing, practices this thing, I can assure the person 60 to 70% catch of the amygdala would cease.
I'm a disciple of that thinking as well. So I'm a great believer that I haven't failed an exam. I've learnt what I didn't know. And I also, the personal accountability, I could do better. I can learn better. I can be more prepared. I can learn more. So yeah, I always think of, as humans, we don't learn through getting things right. We learn through mistakes. We learn through trial and error. We learn through situations. And as I often say, as a young child, we don't learn to walk the first time we stand up. We have to fall over. We have to bang our head. We have to hit our knee. We have to cry and scream and be picked up by a mother. And then we learn about balance. Then we learn about moving one foot in front of the other foot. And then we become proficient enough to be able to run. And we don't run first time. So everything we do in life should be seen as continual learning and enhancement. If we see failure as a setback, we should see failure as an opportunity. And I know that's very cliche and very easy to say, but we have to make mistakes to learn to grow.
I totally agree with you. You don't have to make mistakes. You make mistakes. You see, because you intentionally, you never make a mistake, Joe. It's only in hindsight you say that was a mistake. Because at that point of time, when you took that decision, it was the best decision which you could have taken.
Based on the facts available at that time, that was the decision you made.
So it's not a mistake. It's only when you have grown in wisdom, you have grown in intelligence, you have grown in experiences, you look back and say, hey, I committed a mistake. Mistake is a wrong word. No, you never made a mistake. You will make a mistake if by looking back you don't learn the lesson. That will be a mistake. Because that time you did not have the resources. Today you have the resources. Resources of experience. This is what I mean.
I agree. Yeah, it's, I think if we all were able to frame it that way, because one of the other things I find in the work I do is that one of the biggest barriers, it's the fear of getting it wrong, or the fear of upsetting somebody, or the fear of not having all the answers. And it can hold us back, create limiting beliefs, but also from an inclusion, from a culture perspective, people are so worried about upsetting somebody else that they almost back away rather than engage and have a conversation. And I think that's a challenge we've all got to try and overcome, is put ourselves into that stretch zone, or put ourselves into a position where we can deal with discomfort.
Well, what you're saying is absolutely right, you know. As coaches, right, we know that we need to connect with the heart. And you can connect with the heart only when you discard the element of judgment in your judgment is a product of the brain, of the mind. So first of all, we got to, that's what I do. Discard judgment, open your heart. No one has done any mistake. They've experienced certain things which might have worked for them in the long run, might not have worked for them in the long run. A lot of things I did didn't work for me. When I look back, everything worked for me. Because those mistakes were what gave me the insight, what I should do, what I should not do. So, okay, now coming back to your question. As coaches, I always say, open your heart, connect with the person. Be a good listener. Just listen and listen to them. Then if there have been times, Joe, where my client has spoken to me for an hour and all I've done is 5-6 times, tell me more. Or, that's all. But let me share a case with you. There was a client, that girl called me. For 1 hour, she kept on ranting on the phone. Tuck, tuck, tuck. This is this, blah, 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 blah. I kept on saying, And she said, sir, what is your assessment? I said, you don't have a purpose in life. She got very angry. She banged the phone down. Okay. After 10 days, she calls me. Sir, I was thinking, you're right. I don't have a purpose in life. Would you help me to work on my purpose? And today, I think I must have done a number of sessions with her. She's a changed person. And I'm also helping her in setting up her business. Because I'm a chartered accountant, right? So I understand the business dynamics. And she has become a sort of, say, permanent client of mine as one day. So somewhere, you know, we coaches need to get out of that fear of displeasing the client, because truths are hard to swallow. But at the same time, we got to be polite. We got to be diplomatic, and all truths need not be told at the same time or at the wrong time. We got to be mindful. Is the client prepared to listen to that truth at this point of time or not? I know probably certain coaching philosophies would say, no, this is not done. But then whatever serves my client, whatever helps my client, I think that's the best philosophy.
You mentioned a chartered accountant by profession, of all due respect, a long-standing. You've been in the game a fair while. How have you seen the world of commerce and work evolve over the last 20 or 30 years?
Okay, let me give the story of last 40 years. I became a chartered accountant in 79. The world was very different. We didn't even have the calculators then. So you can, in today's terms, it was very primitive. I'll use the word primitive. You know, when I became a chartered accountant, I asked myself, why have you become a chartered accountant? The traditional practice does not enamor you, does not interest you. Those were the days in India when management consultancy was coming, and I jumped at it. I'll answer your question also, right? And soon I realized, while working with the best, that the best of projects, best of strategies, best of everything fails. Why? Because of one man who's driving the project. Or the problem. So that got me interested into the human dimension. Now, when we come to the human dimension, there are two things very important. There are two things very important for the human being to unleash its full potential or live by his or her full potential. One of the values, aspirations, dreams, self-management, tools and techniques, which come from spirituality. Because human beings are a microcosm of the macrocosm. That's on one side. On the other side is economics. You need money to survive. And this is the reason I say we live in two worlds simultaneously. If our inner world grows without the support of the external world, we become lame ducks. Anyone can come and kick us and kill us. And if our external world grows without corresponding growth of the inner world, we become man-eaters. We'll do anything for survival. So now, this is where the spirituality, human potential, economics came together. And I, being a chartered accountant, that made it much easier for me. So I say, okay, I understand the top line. I understand the bottom line. And what happens between the two lines, right? I can help you in that. So spirituality and economics, when they come together, that is the time human beings flourish. If the church, the temples, the everyone, priests, they want money because that is the way life functions. Now, the question is whether they're greedy or not, that's a different thing. So I'll not bring that into it, otherwise I'll keep going on and on. Now, coming to the transition, the journey, how the businesses have changed, the way I'm looking at it, 80s, it was all about the bottom line. How much profit have you made? Period. This was a year of turmoil because subjective thought, subjective thinking, consciousness, awareness was all thrown out of the window in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 60s. And if you go back to the 1960s, there was an article in Harvard Business Review. It is okay to cheat in business. So that was the scenario. Then the repercussions came. Then I saw the triple profit line coming in. Planet, people, profits. Then came the technology age, the 90s, 2000s. So we moved from the industrial era to the information era. Everything changed, started changing. Computers came in, SOPs started being developed. SAP came into picture. Big organizations came in to produce computers. And after the computers came the information, there came the knowledge age. Today, knowledge is the most important. And whenever a new wave comes, it comes like a tsunami. It disrupts a lot of things, but at the same time, it also constructs a lot of things. So I've seen the transitioning from the industrial era to the IT era to the knowledge era and now to the virtual reality era. When I started my practice, I had to count the numbers, run my finger on the line of numbers and count manually. Today, AI gives me the power to check the way Joe is counting his numbers while he is 7,000, 8,000 miles away from me. Yes, now the question comes, 70% of the people suffer from the ostrich syndrome. When changes happen, they fail to adapt. Why? They love their comfort zone. And their mind says, come on, sleep, it'll pass, it'll pass. Nothing is permanent in the world. It'll pass. Mind doesn't tell them that, look, gentlemen, you are standing on step one. And what this wave is doing is taking you to step two. Step two will pass, but then it'll take the person to step four and you'll be left behind. And to catch up, you've got to get out of your comfort zone. You've got to shun the ostrich syndrome. You've got to look around, accept reality as it is. And now let me come to the present day thing. All these mental challenges which we are facing, I believe WHO has said this is a century of mental challenges, mental issues, mental epidemic. Why? Because 90% people are dissatisfied with themselves. I'll say they are dissatisfied with themselves because they don't know who they are, what they want. They are just copying what their friends do, what the icons do, what the rich do. And they're emulating. They got to recognize who they are. And let me tell you one thing, is that every human being is absolutely unique and will always be unique. Do you know the reason, Joe?
From the moment we're born, our lived experiences, the people we interact with, our DNA, everything diverges.
Exactly. The set of parents, right? The set of parents are unique. Their set of parents were unique. Their set of parents were unique. Their set of parents were unique, if you keep going back. And this uniqueness will not replicate going forward. There might be people like you, but not identical to you. They will not be your clones.
And that takes us back to what we said at the beginning around our spirituality, our soul. Our soul. Yes. Is unique.
Yes.
Who we are.
Yes. And I usually ask people, I said, what is something absolutely unique about you? I can do this. I said, okay, if you can do this, so can I. How come you're unique? Or I got this strength. Okay, if you have, so does Joe. So does Joe has. So what is so unique about it? So does Sally has. So does Rita has. I say, your strengths and weaknesses are unique. And you've got to keep on upskilling your strengths and reducing your weaknesses. They say, why? I said, all opportunities are in the external world. They're constantly going up, 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 becoming more complex, more complex, more complex. They got a certain demand of strengths and weaknesses. Now, your strengths and weaknesses are not matching those demands. What is going to happen? Either you'll fail, you'll not succeed, or your business will slow down, or your growth will slow down, or totally cease. If you want to restart it, you've got to work on yourself. You've got to enhance your strengths, upskill yourself, so you can stretch your hand and capitalize on the opportunity which exists, or which is offering itself to you.
Indeed. What an amazing conversation. I can carry on talking to you all day. How can people contact you?
How do people contact me? Okay, you see, till that time, till COVID had not come. Okay, I'll be very honest. I had my own circle. I've been practicing for 40 years. So people knew about me. Today, my old contacts, they contact me. They contact me through LinkedIn. They contact me through my website. And they contact me through word of mouth. And I believe that the word of mouth is the most potent and the most
important. I agree.
Because it only means if someone is saying, okay, you can go to Sandeep or rely on Sandeep, it means I have made an ambassador, what of that person, an ambassador for me. And this boy or girl or man or woman would speak to as many people as possible without I pushing them to speak. So yes, definitely you got to be visible on social media, which I am, /in/SandeepGuptaDelhi. I got a YouTube channel by Sandeep Gupta Live. My website is guptasandeep.com. And as you rightly said, in the morning, I speak, I coach, and I train on growth and transformation. And I help business leaders, businesses, and individuals in identifying barriers, breaking them, and creating meaningful futures for them, their families, and society.
Sandeep, thank you so much for your time, and it's been an inspiration listening to you and sharing time with you today. Thank you.
I really loved it. Thank you very much. You were a brilliant host.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.